Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Decouple Podcast, where we explore the science and technologies that can decouple human well-being from its ecological impacts, and the politics that can make decoupling possible. Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by three-time returning guest, Doomberg, the little green chicken. I don't think Doomberg requires any introduction because he's our most downloaded guest to date, although we do have some competitors working their way up the chart. So those of you who are longtime listeners no doubt recognize this guest. Maybe there's a few stragglers just joining us recently, but Doomberg has really taken Twitter by storm, has an absolutely incredible Substack, which you should all drop everything and subscribe to. Last time we chatted with Doomberg, those morsels that show up in your email box and spark delight were free, gone behind the paywall since then. So I'm looking forward to catching up with you, Doomberg, about how all that has been going. But today we're going to be chatting about mostly about the European energy crisis. So let's just say hello, welcome. Great to have you back.
Yeah, Chris, it's great to be back. And It's flattering that you would say that we're the most downloaded, because I was going to open by complimenting you on the truly outstanding series of podcasts that you've done with Mark Nelson recently. That, you know, what do you call them? The academies or
the master classes? Yeah,
master class. That's right. Even better. Yes, even better. And I really enjoy the opening music. And it must be said that if anybody is listening to this because of Doomberg, they should stop what they're doing and go back and listen to the Mark Nelson episodes, because they're truly. They truly are a masterclass, and I enjoyed them thoroughly, as I expressed to you via DM and posted on Twitter. And I'm really proud of your success, and it's been fun to watch the Decouple brand grow and to watch your and in our own way try to support the advocacy work that you're doing in nuclear energy. So always happy to be back and looking forward to a robust discussion.
For sure. I mean, not to pat each other's backs too much, but I do have to say that, you know, something I really enjoy about your writing and your way of being in the world, shall we say, is this kind of generosity in terms of cultivating this exciting ecosystem that just continues to grow. Really seeing this not as a zero sum game, but as a place where, you know, crediting and praising one another just elevates the conversation and brings, you know, more and more people on board. You know, that's something that's I think I've held, but it's been strengthened by the example that you share. You know, in your pieces, you're constantly bringing to attention and hyperlinking to other great content. So I just felt that had to be said. Listen, so I think another breakthrough, I do want to catch up on how the Substack is doing, but I think a testament to how compelling of a source of information Doomberg has become is a recent Twitter Spaces that you guys had. I was able to join live for about half an hour, and then I had to hop on Grant Williams' podcast to listen to the rest of it. But tell me a little bit about that. It was pretty well attended. I've been sort of watching on the sideline some Twitter Spaces and wondering, you know, is it a successful medium? Tell me about your experience there.
It was a remarkable event. So I should take a step back and perhaps give some context to how it came about. There is this sort of, I'd say argument is too strong of a word, but a relatively civilized debate on Twitter as to whether the top might be in the European energy crisis and what that even means. And there's a camp that I reside in, and Luke Groman, another great content creator, resides in, that believes that this is sort of analogous to the global financial crisis. And we're at that period sort of in between Bear Stearns and Lehman, where everybody thinks that subprime is contained and that you can quantify the nature of the crisis by measuring the direct cost of the energy challenge. And I believe, and Luke Roman believes, and others believe, that the downstream impacts of what is already a crisis and a catastrophe are just beginning to be felt. But with that background, there are many sort of geopolitical experts and European-focused analysts who think that we, let's just put it out there, are being alarmist. and that the crisis is manageable, and that Putin is the one that is going to suffer the most in the long run, and so on and so on and so on.
It was fascinating because of that. You know, I mean, I think I have a tendency towards you gave me a clinical diagnosis I think on our first episode together, but I was referring it to as this kind of Eastern European tendency to sort of prepare for the worst and be pleasantly surprised sometimes when things don't turn out quite so badly. Do you remember what that diagnosis was? It was brilliant.
Defensive pessimism.
Defensive pessimism.
Which I am a charter member of the club.
Right.
So I have this
tendency towards that. And so it was, I think, a really rich conversation because you had Marco Papik on there. And we'll talk a bit about, you know, some of his arguments and maybe, you know, summarize those before we get onto your other material.
So let's talk about that space. So Marco is a brilliant analyst, successful author of an outstanding book called Geopolitical Alpha. And even though he and I have a different set of opinions on this particular issue, one of the things that is too often missing from modern discourse is a willingness to sit down and to politely exchange views. And to have a civilized debate. And Grant Williams, who is the sort of the ultimate master of ceremonies and everybody's friend and a really brilliant content creator in his own right, agreed to host this space that featured myself, Marco Papich, and Luke Roman, the aforementioned brilliant Luke Roman, who does a lot of great work in this regard as well. And over a period of 2 hours, the four of us had a perfectly lucid, civilized back and forth, where I think both sides made some good points. We had a brief opportunity for people to ask questions of the group. Here's the amazing thing about it. As of today, just on Twitter, that Spaces has been listened to 250,000 times. And then Grant released it on a full podcast, and I think we're at like another 30 or 40,000 listens. The power of Twitter and that this medium of spaces where you have at its apex, I think we had over 6,000 or 7,000 people listening live, a total of 13,500 participated in the way that you did, you know, for some measurable period of time. But the replays have just been spectacular. And the podcast medium, I think, is here to stay, and it has its role, and it's an important role. But there's something vibrant about the Twitter Spaces medium. And, you know, we had a rigorous debate. I felt like I held my own, but I'm obviously very biased in that regard. And I'll let the listeners judge for themselves. But it was a interesting debate, you know, and I think the real confusion, let's say, or the source of disagreement arises from people who have not spent time in the energy sector, assuming they can treat energy as just another commodity. That whereas, as you know, my background, in times of energy abundance, energy is just another commodity. But in times of energy shortages, energy is the only commodity that matters. And that's what we're seeing today, we believe. That's the foundation. It was a great Spaces. And it was a pleasure to be part of it. And we were blown away by the response. And there's something there. Like, this is the way media, news, like the old legacy media is just too slow, not sufficiently dynamic, can't compete with the sort of spontaneous get together of four experts with different backgrounds, rigorously but politely expressing deeply held and well-researched reviews views.
Absolutely. I think that's what made it so special in the context of hyperpolarization to see that civil debate. And, you know, again, I find myself engaging in sort of a cognitive forcing strategy, again, to deal with that defensive pessimism, to really try and put myself and challenge that bias. And maybe things aren't as bad as they seem. And so it was very useful to get Marco's perspective. You know, I use this podcast a lot as a way to fill in my weaknesses and educate myself, you know, despite it being something that, you know, I offer out there for free. It is a selfish project in terms of, you know, this educational path. And, you know, I haven't engaged in the crypto stuff, or I don't have a very good understanding of, you know, monetary theory at all. But I was interested in what you were saying there in terms of, you know, when there is an energy crunch, that's when things really matter. You're famously quoted as saying, you know, energy is life. But to a certain degree, I've heard many people argue that, you know, energy is money, energy is currency. And I'm interested in exploring that with you as we sort of dive into the EU energy crisis and the responses and the, you know, the anti-logic TM, which is another phrase you coined recently. But again, particularly when it comes to, you know, the price caps, the bailouts, impacts on inflation, I think that's sort of where I would like to sort of make the central theme of this interview. And again, I'm sure I've, you know, been reading all your pieces very closely and taking notes. I'm sure we'll sort of go off on some nice paths. But in terms of sort of giving the listeners a sense of, you know, what I hope to get into and what I hope to learn, I'm really excited to get into that. But maybe we can start off with maybe a summary of what you feel have been some of the key events to date. Obviously, we don't need to be comprehensive and go on for a long time here, but I just think it'd be useful. You know, for those who have not been paying as close attention, or for those who are curious as to what you see as the most important events, say, of the last few months in informing this crisis, so that we can look forward and try and anticipate where it's going.
So there are sort of two major trends that that have converged into a crisis. And one, which has been well documented by your friend Mark Nelson and many others, is that the introduction of massive amounts of intermittent sources of power into the European electricity grid has caused significant damage to that grid. But concurrent with that has been a reluctance to produce their own fossil fuels and an over-reliance on cheap, steady, readily available pipeline source natural gas from Russia. And then third, the attack on nuclear power. So if you're going to introduce intermittency while simultaneously attacking baseload, while simultaneously outsourcing the drilling and processing and production of your fossil fuels, you leave yourself extraordinarily vulnerable to evil geopolitical actors like Vladimir Putin. And so one of the things that we have that has frustrated us with the discourse is by pointing out the flaws in our logic, many just write us off as sort of pro-Putin or, you know, anti-West, which right. is, of course, the exact opposite is the truth. And one thing you'll notice, for example, we've never written about, nor have we ever tweeted about, any military aspects of this conflict. Why is that? We know nothing about it, so we have nothing to add. We have limited our contributions to the discourse in this regard to the areas where we know and feel like we have some unique expertise and that we can participate in a value-added way. And so we have focused all of our commentary on trying to point out why the energy aspect of the hybrid war that we were fighting with Putin was destined to be a disappointment, and suggesting from the very beginning alternative ways that we might be able to improve the situation, both for the benefit of the citizenry of Western Europe and also for reducing the leverage that we have so foolishly handed to Vladimir Putin. So it is in that context that we now enter what we believe is, and have been saying for months, the greatest geopolitical event to unfold is how Western Europe will confront the winter of 2022-2023 with what essentially amounts to a shortage of molecules. And so once you realize that you have a shortage of molecules, all of the responses to that shortage that don't involve making more molecules ultimately are going to fail. And we're seeing a lot more of that than we are of a stated desire to make or get more molecules.
It's interesting, you know, when I think about the challenges of 2022, it's almost been a kind of dream wish list of the green movement. We're really kind of experiencing the great sort of degrowth experiment of 2022 in Europe. You know, I've heard many environmental thinkers hoping fervently that fossil fuels will become incredibly expensive, because that's going to mean people will use less energy and be into conservation. This idea of energy rationing is something that comes up a lot, you know, on the green left in particular. You know, in terms of a deindustrialization agenda of the degrowth movement, you know, high energy costs are leading to that result. And I mean, in the logical conclusion of a degrowth argument, the more sort of dark Malthusian undertones, the potential for some degree of depopulation due to famine as a result of the fertilizer crisis. The green movement's even getting, despite the incredible illogic of this, their fantasy of closing nuclear plants fulfilled. It's been quite a year when you look at it, you know, through that very dark lens.
So in the piece we put out last night called Green Shoots of Logic, we did, you know, make sure to survey the world and see where even some of the sort of more radical leaning progressives in the Western world are beginning to see the light in this regard. And we closed the piece by saying the one country that is still, you know, heading full throttle towards the hard wall of physics is Germany. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's almost too far gone for Germany for this winter. And in the piece we quoted how annoyed their neighbors are at their insistence on closing the last three nuclear reactors. And Sweden in particular is talking about cutting off Germany from its precious ability to produce electricity, because if you're going to be so foolish, we're not going to sacrifice our population and your sort of, this is not a shared sacrifice. Right. This is a, you own the blunder, you own the consequences. I think the best remaining outcome is the rest of the West gets to observe what happens in Germany and course corrects. Yeah. I think Germany is too far gone, and I think they have done severe, and I mean severe damage to their manufacturing base, which is just now beginning to be felt. And this is what makes Twitter sort of toxic and great at the same time. We have lots of people sort of mocking us for saying Europe will survive the winter. And we put out a tweet last night that said, we're old enough to remember when, quote, we'll survive the winter was a pretty low bar.
Right.
The consequences of the energy blunders will take some time to manifest downstream, but you're already seeing it. The German chemical industry is going to get decimated. That German chemical industry is a fulcrum that holds up an enormous amount of downstream value add. You know, Zoltan had a great piece where he talked about how 20 billion of energy is foundational to 2 trillion of value add, and it's 100-to-1 leverage in his sort of comparison to the Lehman moment that we alluded to earlier. This is a real catastrophe that we are talking about. They will survive should tell you just how much the goalposts have moved. When we started the sanctions regime against Putin, the objective was to turn the ruble into rubble and to cause hyperinflation in Russia. And we are seeing the rebound of those sanctions. And, you know, Goldman Sachs predicting that the UK would experience 22% inflation before it would abate. Like, these are catastrophic numbers.
Yes.
The crisis is here. Mm-hmm. The predicted crisis has arrived. The only challenge now is how do you minimize it and prepare for, you know, the second, third, and fourth order effects.
You know, speaking of Germany, a listener sent me a great image. I may be getting this wrong. I think it was the HMS Savannah. And I think, you know, the nuke bros out there are aware of the U.S. ship, the Savannah. It was one of the first or maybe the only nuclear-powered cargo ship. But I think it was the HMS Savannah was one of the first steamships to cross the Atlantic. It was steam, but it was also rigged with sails. And I retweeted this recently, a picture of that boat, you know, two tall masts with kind of insufficient sails really on them. And then a great big smokestack, presumably for a coal-fired propulsion system. And that really is, I think, a great symbol of the German electricity grid, that fossil fuel input that can actually get that boat across the Atlantic. The fuel for that has been incredibly constrained by the Russian sanctions. And now we're heading into winter, into the so-called, I love this word, the Dunkelflaute. The Germans actually have a word for this period of, you know, weeks to months in which it's the doldrums of winter. There's no wind, there's no sun. And, you know, they're leaning on this energy system, which is dependent on the two of those things. It really is pretty mind-boggling.
You'll be happy to know that we actually used that word in a Doomberg piece.
The Dunkelflaute.
It's one of the best German words. I'd say it's solidly in the top 10 of German words, and that's saying something.
100%. And so topical right now. So topical right now. So, you know, there was a tweet. I really want to credit folks, as you've taught me to do here, and I did write down some notes here. Might have to take a second to find it. But There was a great tweet, again, looking at the implications of this energy crisis on German society. And it was talking about how, you know, Germany is this place with free tuition, with generous support for the arts. You know, it's a vibrant social democracy, a very generous welfare state. And, you know, almost as a result of that, very few people have an appreciation for the productive forces within that society that generate the wealth that that enables that kind of prosperity. You know, it's a kind of classic story, I guess, of almost like a kind of post-material environment where people forget about, again, those productive forces. And, you know, he was forecasting that those days may be over, that Germany could be headed towards what he was comparing to sort of the failing states of places, you know, in the, I guess, middle income areas, Egypt, et cetera, which has to expend a huge amount of its budget every year subsidizing food and fuel, just these kind of bare necessities. You know, I think, I believe it was Marco again, was arguing that this is likely to be a short-term event, that Europe can recover, that, you know, gas storage is full, that, you know, LNG has supplanted Russian imports. The EU is only down about 5% in terms of their total gas imports. You know, I did find some of that to be compelling. And again, I try and really entertain those arguments as a way to challenge my defensive pessimism, as you've labeled it. Where are you at with that? I mean, how bad do you think things are going to be? Clearly, you think it's going to be a tough winter. But in terms of this blow to the productive forces of German society, to German heavy industry, chemical industry, do you feel like this is recoverable?
We recovered from World War II, right, and the complete destruction of these countries. So, of course, it's recoverable. The question at issue is, what is the path function and what is the pain that needs to be felt, you know, integrated across the next 12 to 18 months? For it to happen. And I will say in the piece, you know, Green Shoots of Logic, the UK has already pivoted, and we give Liz Truss full credit for, you know, not all of her policies are what we would do, but on the supply side, she's the first of the sort of broader European leaders to recognize reality and to say, this is a supply crisis. Mm-hmm. And the words that she used, which were very encouraging, we shall never let the UK find itself in this position again.
Right.
And so a big push for nuclear, a big push for natural gas, and bridging as much coal as they need, unfortunately. But we have not yet seen what we would call intellectual capitulation out of the Germans. And in fact, we've seen the opposite, which is a doubling and tripling of down, mm-hmm, of anti-logic. Even in Sweden, as we're talking, the votes are still being counted, but it looks like there's a rightward tilt in the Swedish parliamentary election that happened over the weekend here. This is something we predicted as well, and what we fear in Germany, and what we fear in Italy, and sort of like if you deny physics long enough, the population will revolt. Mm-hmm. And and so the insistence so for example, back to the storage thing and Marco's point, and one that I felt I made pretty clearly on the spaces, and I'll summarize here very briefly. Storage is never meant to be a primary source of natural gas. It was always and only meant to be a supplement to pre-existing flows. And there are significant constraints to accessing the total natural gas stored on the days where you need it the most, which is you can only pump so much out at a certain rate. And the rate at which you can pump natural gas out of storage decreases as a function of the amount of material that you have in storage. Mm. And this is, of course, is a heterogeneous characteristic of each of the individual storage units, but broadly speaking, as a general rule, if, for example, Germany had to rely on just storage or storage for most of its daily use on any particular day, it wouldn't work.
Right.
And the fact that Russia has completely cut off Nord Stream 1 and could still cut off the remaining gas coming in via Ukraine, especially if military advances by Ukraine continue to proceed with some positivity, it could be that Germany finds itself in a situation where it will not have enough natural gas to both maintain the heating of its residences and keep its industry working. And the German economic minister, Habeck, who's just let's speak bluntly, a clown, said casually on national television in Germany that it's okay. These small businesses can just stop operating for a few months and it's no big deal. as though they don't have, debt to repay or wages to pay, or that they might just decide to close their business. You know, this is, again, a person who has never spent a day in business and has no idea how to run a P&L, and is the most powerful economic leader in Germany, which is the most powerful country in Europe. And, as we said on Twitter, when you're led by clowns, you should expect a circus.
I mean, the quality of leadership in the West, broadly speaking, is astounding. The kind of gerontocracy that we see in the U.S. I won't comment too much on my prime minister here. Habeck, PhD in literature, I think best known for writing children's books. As you said, probably the most powerful man in Europe at this point in terms of economic policy. I guess in terms of, the recoverability, clearly with the right policies in place and, with the U.S. able to bankroll a Marshall Plan, Europe was able to rebuild itself from World War II. I was reading a very interesting Twitter thread. I think I tagged you in it. It's a gentleman, if I'm not getting his name wrong, Alexander Stahil. He's an investor in Switzerland, amazing guy. But he was really talking about how differently Europe is positioned, particularly when it comes to its electricity production, facing the 73 and 79 energy shocks versus today's, and in 79, I mean, Europe was rapidly building out a nuclear fleet, putting 200 gigawatts of nuclear plants online, building, reliable electricity. Obviously, they had a lot of oil fired generation, which took a big hit, but it was kind of a different trajectory. And I thought Stahl did an amazing job of pointing out the absolute precarity of this, what Robert Bryce, is referring to as, the network of all networks. I call it the civilizational life support structure. I mean, there's going to need to be some massive policy change arounds. And you mentioned that with Liz Truss in the UK. I'm really struck by the kind of NIMBYism that we see. I mean, It's fine to be importing Russian gas. That's not been a huge problem for Europe. It's kind of an out of sight, out of mind thing, offshoring emissions from manufacturing to China, for instance. I think there may be some shock to seeing, fracking rigs in the beautiful UK countryside. But it is just interesting that degree of kind of make-believe and NIMBYism in Europe, where I think, they feel like they're making huge leaps forward on climate, but really just offshoring a lot of resource extraction and manufacturing.
It can't be avoided. It is stunning to see, in real time. And little Twitter exchange last night, like NAFTA, US, Canada, and Mexico have enormous potential compared to Europe, because we are largely already energy and commodity independent. We have can-do suite of nuclear power, which could be spread across the region. We have ample farmland. We have ample fertilizer production. We have ample natural gas production. Canadian natural gas is trading for, what, $5 per million BTU, $4 per million BTU. It's trapped there.
Landlocked.
landlocked in Canada. We have the potential here to be an energy superpower. None of that exists in Europe. So, yes, there will be a recovery in Europe in the long term. But there's the opportunity cost of lost potential that is real. And as you're seeing these remarkable and sad stories, sadly predictable stories too, I might add, of small business owners taking to Twitter to complain about 500 and 600% increases in their electricity bills, which they simply can't handle, which is forcing the governments of Germany and the UK to print fiat to support these people, which is only going, you can't print molecules, and so it's only going to make the incremental cost of a molecule all that much higher for two reasons. There's more fiat floating around, and you are breaking the market mechanism to try and figure out what the most efficient use of your limited molecules should be. And so they're taking the anti-logical approach, as we put in a piece two or three pieces ago. They can be counted upon to take the worst decision at every opportunity now, because we're in crisis mode, and none of the leaders before Liz Truss seem to have any sort of logical connection to reality that you and I might have by having been citizens in the real world and not sort of the noble elite of European decadence.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that the kind of monetary policy response. You've profiled a few of these, both the Don't Pay UK action. You've also highlighted, I think this was Liz Truss' plan for an energy bailout totaling $170 billion. There was a great tweet, I think, from Javier Blas talking about, you know, you think Hinkley Point is expensive. I think it's clocking in around $20 billion. It'll produce, I'm not sure if it's 10 or 13% of the UK's electricity, but you can just do the math on that if you spent $170 billion on nuclear. Even assuming that cost didn't come down from serial production, you'd be, you know, something like 73% of electricity coming from nuclear. Instead, that's going to a bailout. You know, and you were mentioning this chance of hyperinflation. I think Goldman Sachs predicting a 22% inflation rate in the UK. You know, let's talk a little bit about that. Again, I'm on shaky ground here. I do not have a strong background in this area at all. But again, I was referencing that concept of yours, energy is life, and this idea as well that, you know, energy is fundamental. It really underpins currency. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, unless and until, this is a point that Luke Grohman makes quite persuasively in his paywalled materials that we happily subscribe to. Unless and until the UK and the EU can procure energy in their own currency, then they're just printing fiat, and they're not going to get the molecules. And so most energy is settled in U.S. dollars, and Russia is looking to settle, you know, with friendly countries in local currency. So if you can settle your energy needs in local currency, that means you can print your energy needs, and the UK and the EU cannot do that today. And so it's actually 170 billion British pounds, wow. Not dollars, wow. Which is, you know, multiplied by 1.15, although that might not be the case for much longer as this continues. So if again, by printing fiat that you cannot directly use to acquire your energy needs, you are simultaneously increasing the price in local nominal fiat of that same molecule and destroying the normal market forces that would otherwise be able to dictate to you the most efficient places within your economy for your limited molecules to go.
Right.
And so it's a losing strategy on both fronts. Now look, the US can print dollars and people accept dollars for energy. So the US can print energy.
Right.
And the US is also relatively energy independent in the sense that already we produce more than we need. And we trade, you know, to match what we need, you know, the particularities of industry. But we also have readily accessible reserves that we could tap with the right political will and financial support, such that we can satisfy almost everything that we need internally. The UK and the EU are both sitting in currencies that aren't used to settle energy, and therefore must acquire U.S. dollars, for example. To buy the energy they need, and they don't produce enough,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have the political will internally yet. Like her speech, Liz Truss's speech was controversial in the UK.
Right, right.
How dare you talk about fracking in the UK? Or you still have people gluing themselves to, you know, the Speaker of Parliament's chair in London. You have these fringe extremist groups drilling holes in all of the tires of milk delivery trucks for some perverted reason. Yeah, they took out 50 of them in one night and were bragging about it on Twitter. So we have a lot more pain for these people to suffer before the political capitulation that is necessary for a sane path forward and recovery presents itself.
I mean, and the timelines, again, I think I'm referring probably to a Robert Bryce podcast with the head of Mercator. You know, just, you know, if the rigs were there, if the workforce was there, how long would it take to get gas flowing out of this, you know, fracked wells in the UK? And they were saying, you know, at least two years.
Yeah.
And then with nuclear, you know, the best time to have built nuclear was 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Second best time is today. These things are going to take time. And it's also occurring in an environment, you know, of a deindustrialized Europe where there's been, you know, such a loss of the human capital required to build a productive economy, to build energy infrastructure. It is daunting. And I think this is where my defensive pessimism is maybe taking over a little bit.
We had a friend, Alfonso from Macro Compass. We were on a Spaces together, different Spaces, the one we talked about earlier. And he made a great analogy, which is the European Union today can be thought of as a sort of emerging market economy on the cusp of hyperinflation, because it is experiencing a sort of exogenic shock for which it cannot print the solution.
Right.
So if you're Argentina and you owe billions of dollars of US dollar denominated debt, There's no amount of your local currency that you can print to make good on that debt. And because Europe does not produce its own energy, and the energy it needs is not settled in its local currency, this shock is totally analogous to what happens in developing economies, except it's transpiring in the developed world, and we would argue, not to really freak you out, the population of Europe and Germany are far less prepared to weather such storms than the population of Argentina, who's had to do it a dozen times in the past 50 years. This is going to be the dislocation between the perceived range of potential outcomes amongst the average German citizen and what seems on offer right now is profound. And it's not clear to us that the integrity of the institutions within a country like Germany are prepared to weather that storm. Now, look, it's Doomberg, and as we've said 100 times, we would love nothing more than to come back here in 1 year and for you to label us as having been alarmist. That would be great. We would proudly wear the alarmist badge if it meant that the people of Europe did better than we fear. We'd make that trade today all day long.
Yeah. I mean, we've been, you know, and a credit to Mark Nelson here, we've been forecasting big trouble in Europe for about probably 16 months now on Decouple. And I take no satisfaction in our content being somewhat prophetic in terms of what's happening here. I guess, you know, I'm wondering in terms of Europe's future, you know, the, for instance, German industry, energy prices before this crisis were probably double that of the US. They made up for that because of incredible efficiency, having a highly educated workforce, really quality products. All of that basis for, you know, the things with which Europe still produces value are being undermined by this. And, you know, if energy is twice as expensive, you can survive that with some of the qualities I mentioned before. But if it's 10 times as expensive, we're in a real world of pain.
But you're making a slight mistake, which we highlighted on the spaces, which I'd like to articulate here.
Please.
Electricity prices were double.
Yes.
Energy prices were cheap. And electricity is 20% of the energy bill. And so electricity prices being double, but the energy being cheap because of this dependence on Russian natural gas means that energy prices going up 10x is a way bigger deal than electricity prices doubling because of the intermittency that was introduced to the grid.
Right.
And if your electricity prices double, that means your energy bill has gone up by 10%. But your energy bill now is up by multiple fold, which is a catastrophic situation and far more difficult for a value-add economy like Germany to just pass on to the consumer. So again, this is one of the things that sort of people, even you, with all of your experience and all the shows that you've recorded, the profoundness of this catastrophe is because it has, the cancer has spread from electricity to energy. Energy is heating homes, it is producing chemicals, it is producing fertilizer, it is all of the rest of the economy that occurs off the grid. And we're talking about the whole enchilada doubling, tripling, quadrupling 5x in price, as opposed to a doubling of electricity prices, which can be reasonably contained and passed on if you have enough productivity improvements and all of the other attributes you just described.
You know, I had that written in my notes, actually, that distinction, but, you know, it takes a while, I think, to get it through this thick skull of mine. But thank you for pointing that out. You mentioned the Swedish elections and the kind of course correction that may be required, and it may be, you know, politically ugly in terms of some of the forces that may come to bear. I was talking with a great friend of the podcast, Noah Rettberg, who we had that episode, Germany, the Canary in the Coal Mine, that's also done very, very well in terms of our downloads. But, you know, he was talking about how, you know, unlike in France, where Marie Le Pen comes very close to winning the presidency on their presidential election cycles, the German far right, you know, there's a real understandable reason why the establishment is does everything they can to really marginalize them. But that, you know, their voices, they won't necessarily be elected, but the policies they put forward, in order for the mainstream to sort of take their potential electoral success away, those ideas might start to infiltrate into the political middle. I'm not sure, you know, in terms of your kind of political commentary here, but I'm just wondering what you think you know, beyond the energy and economic impacts, what the sort of political course correction may look like if you're paying attention to that?
Well, I mean, again, take your home country and the recent, you know, ascension of what the CBC is desperately trying to label as an unelectable populace to the Conservative Party leadership in a sort of surprisingly easy defeat of the establishment candidate Jean Charest. We're going to see that play out in many countries to the extent that these elections are sort of open and fair.
Mm-hmm.
But the bubble in which the leaders who got us here reside in is pretty remarkable, and they'll be the last to know. I actually don't believe in the sort of wild, not wild, but the becoming ever more reasonable conspiracy theories that this is somehow all on purpose. We're still in the incompetence camp. The incompetence camp is informed by our direct experience at the high levels of corporate America, where board members and C-suite executives not only literally had no clue what's going on two, three, four levels below them, but believe what they're saying. Mm-hmm, like they say it enough times that they actually believe it. Like, I actually think that Habeck believes that nuclear is part of the problem and not the solution, because he says it so often that I think he believes it. And also, I think he thinks that businesses can shut down for 2 months or 3 months and be just fine and not worry about it, because he has no clue how business works. And so if you're that confident in your ignorance, how confident are you in your permanence? And so they will be the last to see it. As we've said many times, on the path from abundance to starvation is riot. And there's a very short path from empty grocery stores to the guillotine. Mm-hmm. And when we say that, it's only half, you know, jokingly. These people have no clue. They'll be the last to know. Who started the piece with the Romania, the collapse of the Romanian dictatorship? I think it was Matt Taibbi, a really great piece. You know, like, Ceausescu was the last to know. He was baffled by why the crowd was angry with him as he was telling them to stop storming his headquarters. You know, that this is exactly, there's no difference in this scenario. And so I think the people that live in bubbles are the last to know that there's a giant needle coming.
And anti-establishment politicians are, I mean, the surprise in the Hillary camp at Trump's sweeping of, you know, the Rust Belt, I think is probably instructive of some of what's
we live in the Rust Belt, and I can assure you it was no surprise to us.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, you quoted this as well. I think I tweeted it similarly, but I'm forgetting the exact article it comes out of. But the quote is in reference to Habeck and the Greens, what they're doing with their nuclear plants. In regards to this ridiculous plan of, you know, sacrificing one on the altar and keeping two in reserve, which is a very strange way to operate nuclear, particularly on a massive grid. I know that was another real learning point from Alexander Stahel's tweet thread was, you know, there's this European grid. It connects something like 42 countries, 520 million consumers. You know, a lot of the rationale that is being put forward by the Germans is, well, you know, we're facing a gas shortage, not really an electricity shortage. And we you know, nuclear will not offset that much gas use, you know, forgetting that they're part of a grid. But all that to as an aside, the quote was, you know, for the Greens, it was a win to show their party base that they were standing up for their core beliefs, despite reactivating coal power plants and super fast tracking fossil fuel import infrastructure. I mean, this is really the party of nihilism. God is dead, but the devil still exists. And it seems like their only core belief nowadays is that, you know, nuclear is the ultimate source of evil, and they're willing to sacrifice, you know, any environmental commitment on that altar. It's truly astounding.
It is the most robust demonstration of an intellectually bankrupt position that I have ever had the unfortunate experience of reading, if we're being totally honest. Like, they claim to care about carbon emissions primarily. And yet they are willing to sacrifice the cleanest form of energy production with the least amount of carbon emissions in exchange for the dirtiest form with the most. If we had written this as a script for Hollywood, right, they would reject it as foolish.
Right.
Like, there's no way that could transpire. But it just shows you the cult aspect of all of this, that this has become a religion, and that the purity of your beliefs is far more important than the logical underpinnings of those same beliefs. This is a, an acid test for acceptance into a perverse cult, with all of the pressures that come with it. You know, like people who are victims of cults don't realize it in the moment. They honest that that's the whole scam. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of social pressure to demonstrate purity, and that's what's going on here. There's just no other way to describe it.
It is bizarre because, you know, there's obviously a big environmental backlash against Liz Truss' ending of the fracking ban. The German Greens are, you know, reigniting their lignite sector. I mean, there's some parallels here in terms of a kind of pro-fossil fuels agenda by, you know, both Liz Truss and bizarrely the Greens. I mean, there's some attempts here from the supply side to increase supply of fossil fuels, and it's coming from some very unlikely champions in the German Green Party.
So this is an example of what we talked about in our latest piece, which is, I think the best case scenario now is the rest of the world begins to come to its senses. And if Germany's hell-bent on, you know, national suicide, then the sort of next best alternative for the rest of the world is to observe that and make sure it doesn't get replicated anywhere else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's not much we can do for Germany now. Like, they have tossed the die. And it's come up snake eyes, and they've decided to hold hands and to stay in the barrel and go over Niagara Falls. That's a tragedy. There's only so much forewarning you can give people. Ultimately, you know, they're a free country, and they can do and govern themselves as they please. It's going to be tragic. We have many German friends. We have many German friends who disagree with the course of the country. Mm-hmm. But it is what it is. Like, tragedies happen. The sort of fallback position, the regroup position for the rest of the world is observe what happens when we are stupid enough to run this experiment, and then make sure we have the political will to avoid a replication of that experiment anywhere else in the world.
More broadly, in terms of the responses of Canada, the U.S., you know, we had Chancellor Olaf Scholz coming to Canada, basically begging us for, you know, LNG export capacity to increase. You know, you've talked about, you know, the path to defeat Putin being very different from what is on offer in terms of particularly the North American response. Outline that a little bit for us.
Yeah. You know, Canada is kind of this weird, well, not to get too political, we've written some pretty tough pieces on your current prime minister, and we think he's a particularly dangerous character, but that's probably too polarizing for your audience. Canada has a ton of stranded natural gas that could help the world decarbonize, actually, because that natural gas could be used as a bridging source of fossil fuels to displace coal while we implement smart policies around nuclear. Canada is sort of this weird outlier in the sense that it at the same time that that's occurring, Trudeau is invoking treaty rights to try to get Line 5 and the closure of Line 5, this critical pipeline from Alberta, reversed, the scheduled closure of it, or the attempted closure of it. And so, like, on that particular issue, which we've both written about and threaded about on Twitter, Trudeau is on the same side as the fossil fuel industry, mm-hmm. Which is a bit peculiar. Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, which is something we've been saying from the beginning, NAFTA, if you just draw a circle around North America, it's a spectacularly blessed area with all the resources needed to not only support abundance for our population, but to project geopolitical power by exporting that abundance to friendly allies. And every day that we do not sort of get together and collectively take advantage of that abundance, there's a reason why all of the European powers try to settle North America, right? I mean, it is literally an endless source of everything the world needs for abundance. Every day that we don't take full advantage of that, the opportunity cost is higher for the countries that could be benefiting from it. But it's also real here. And Canada, you know, with its nuclear heritage and with its abundance of fossil fuels and its abundance of great farmland and its abundance of natural resources and mining, and, you know, it literally has everything and has a very small population. And we've pushed back on some sort of Canada bears on Twitter spaces, you know, which have since been lost to the internet. But, you know, on a per capita basis, Canadians are among the wealthiest in the planet. Probably second only to Australia, if you just look at sort of resource blessing divided by population.
Right.
Great institutions, great education, great, you know, controversially, but very good public health. And then just this mountain of resources, all it takes is the political will to exploit it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. You know, I guess coming from my political and environmental background, you know, I think initially in this journey, you know, the plan was just let's get a global Mesmer plan going and make 1,000 nuclear reactors bloom as a way to sort of leapfrog over fossil fuels and avoid those nuanced and difficult discussions about, okay, well, what do we develop from a fossil fuel perspective, you know, from a climate hawk background. But it is interesting, you know, as I've delved into this more, you know, and as a humanist, understanding the real proximate dangers of energy crisis. And again, I hope that we had you on, you know, in April of this year to talk about your piece, The Perfect Storm, that was facing global agriculture. Again, I hope that was alarmist and fear-mongering in the end. But, you know, we're going to see the Decoupled team is going to the climate conference in what I'm calling the Versailles Climate Conference. This is in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. I've been there before, this, you know, insane resort town. I'm really worried about there being hunger on the streets of Cairo. You know, in any case, I guess I'm just trying to say that, it's been an interesting personal development for me, and I'm still wrestling with it. You know, the need, to, you know, certainly use fossil fuels as a bridge towards, getting toward, a nuclear future, to both tackle climate change, but not really, you know, tank humanity in the pursuit of it. You know, this energy crisis, I think, we'll see. It's still blooming. In terms of the food impacts, how long do you think that's going to take? You know, you wrote that piece on the potential for the very real potential for famine back in April. How is that panning out? And what are the kind of timelines in terms of when nitrogen, for instance, nitrogen shortages will affect crop yields?
You know, we're seeing it play out now in Europe as the complete devastation of its ammonia production capabilities will eventually lead to a shortage of fertilizer, which has to impact yields. You know, it's the perverse irony of all of this, of course, is that the world could, you know, as it exists, they could easily feed every human on the planet with the resources that we have, with the resources that we waste. But it has played out in the emerging economies, and food inflation is real in the Western world. And, you know, emergency room doctors or successful newsletter writers might find it as a relative annoyance that we have to pay 30-40% more than we were last year's. But for many families in our own societies, that means tough choices between, you know, where they're going to get their protein and the quality of the foods that they're able to buy. And it's going to have health impacts. And, you know, it's a shame because it doesn't need to happen. You know, if you just, it's sort of a high level macro measurement, you would say, you know, if an alien came down, and measured the sort of global human condition, against Maslow's hierarchy of needs,
right,
the disparity between how the top 1-3%, which we would, both agree that we are blessed enough to fall in, the disparity between the top 1-3% and the bottom 80%. Is staggering and unethical inhuman. And so this is just sort of dastardly icing on a terrible cake, I guess, like that we've made a terrible situation worse. We've exacerbated those inequalities. And so to many in the world, that the things we've written in April have already come true. They just don't make the headlines because it's not in Western Europe yet. And it's not, you know, it's not encroaching on North America. But South America, Southeast Asia, we are seeing the beginnings of food riots. Sri Lanka's complete collapse, which you have documented thoroughly here, is a direct consequence of such policy-making decisions. And I think, again, one of the challenges with us is we're early, and then when stuff doesn't quite play out at the speed with which the modern sort of dopamine-induced news cycle, compressed news cycle demands, it's easy to say that, oh, you know, you guys were just being alarmist. I'd say let's give it 3 to 4 more months with radically reduced ammonia production in Europe, just as we head into the spring planting season, before we realize the you know, we can measure the full integrated impact of the primary energy crisis. This is like the snapping of a whip, and energy is at the very front end of the supply chains, and where the tip of the whip smacks the floor, and when it does, is less interesting to us than the fact that it must inevitably.
Mm-hmm. So let's, we have a few more minutes here. On the topic of the energy required to make the ammonia, we are in a global fossil fuel shortage. Again, from that tweet thread, a really outstanding tweet thread from Alexander Stahel, he was just talking about where the investment cycle is at, that basically to finance the global fossil fuel industry for just a stable baseline amount of production, he was estimating it's about $300 billion of investment required every year, and we're down to about half of that. In the short term, to avoid famine, starvation, to lower energy prices, to disempower Putin, there's going to need to be investment in order to increase the supply of energy. One of the responses and one of the ways that is being talked about to fund some of the energy bailouts is a windfall tax on fossil fuel producers. Can you talk us through a little bit about the logic or anti-logic of that position?
Well, look, let's take a step back. If you're short molecules, the very best way to allocate the molecules across more demand than you can supply is through market forces. And so, for example, one of those market forces might dictate that fertilizer producers should be at the front of the line, given the criticality of their product to food. By handing out stimulus in fiat and absorbing the blow, we are creating artificially, at least temporarily, more demand in less efficient uses of that energy than otherwise would be. Mm. This gets back to the point I made earlier about an inability to print energy means you can only print fiat. And when you print fiat for political purposes, which is totally understandable, totally predictable, and I think regimes in such situations are batting 1,000 for making this exact same mistake every time. It's not like the history books aren't clear as to what's coming next. Mm-hmm. But one real example is by handing out 170 billion pounds of stimulus, you are masking the market forces that would otherwise tell you that your local ammonia producers should get the first crack at the limited molecules you have left. And so when they don't, they shut down. And when they shut down, farmers can't afford to plant. And when farmers can't afford to plant, there was a story today from Financial Times that we tweeted out without comment that basically salad growers are going out of business because the energy to keep their greenhouses warm in these relatively northern climates is inaccessible relative to the price they could charge for their product.
Right.
And so these are all sort of standard theories of economics where price caps don't work. They lead to supply shortages. Obfuscating market signals leads to suboptimal allocation of shortages. This is one of the points we made in one of our very first pieces, which we're ashamed to read now because the quality is so much better today. Is that, the classic example, hurricanes coming into the Gulf Coast and people are trying to get out, and hurricane comes and the power is down and the price of generators skyrocket from $400 to $2,500 for a portable generator. The government would call that gouging. And so retailers don't do it. And so the signal to the rest of the country that could easily ship their generators in that cost $400 and they could capture that spread is not sent. And the aftermath is tougher than it needed to be, and goes on for longer than it should have. That's a real example of the political grandstanding around quote unquote price gouging is nothing more than the obfuscation of real market signals that would bring in needed supply. The clearing price of $2,500 for a generator would trigger all manner of people in their pickup trucks bringing lightly used generators down to the region to try and sell them, which is the exact supply response you want in an emergency. That's not going to happen today in the UK or in Germany or in Western Europe as the politicians are spinning too many plates. So the political plate is we must shield our voters from the impact of this cost, which is laudable and understandable and dead wrong, which means your ammonia producers aren't going to get their molecules, which means your chemical producers aren't going to get their molecules, which means in some instances, your electricity producers aren't going to get their molecules. It's perverse. It's understandable, but it's also very destructive. And unfortunately, history is filled with just this exact behavior and what inevitably must follow.
And then on the topic of the other side of things, in terms of taxing the kind of windfall profits.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just again, obvious, political populism. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, nothing triggers a robust desire to invest in a critically needed resource than the government taking away all of your profits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is too tempting and too irresistible for the politicians. It's a flaw in our democratic system, if we're being totally honest. It is also an affront to contract law. And contract law is probably the strongest foundation for robust institutions that lead to successful societies. And effective rewriting of contract law to say this right-tailed gain that you were not hoping for, but possibly incorporating into your analysis when you decided to invest in the resource development, we're going to take that away from you now. Well, what does that tell the next round of investors? I will never have that right tail possibility, which means I will move my money somewhere else and I will invest it somewhere else, which is why we have half of the amount of maintenance capital even going into the fossil fuel industry than would be needed just to maintain what we do today, let alone growth capital for the development of future resources.
I mean, is there any role for, and again, this is not an area I'm super familiar with, but would there be any role for the government mandating that those profits are spent in terms of reinvestment rather than paying out, you know, dividends to shareholders, for instance? I'm just trying to think.
Any government interference is going to be bearish for incremental future investment. Mm-hmm. Whose property is it?
I'm thinking of wartime rationing and some of the measures taken, say, in World War II for the British Isles to resist fascist takeover. I mean, would you argue that it's purely the market that should steward those scarce resources and make those decisions? Or
you can't do wartime rationing without wartime sacrifice, and by issuing these giant stimulus packages, they are trying to have their cake and eat it too, which is there shall be no sacrifice, but we will impose central planning rationing upon otherwise capitalistic productive industries. Mm-hmm, and we all know how that goes. Like the history is undefeated in this regard. Mm. And so it is the worst, again, the anti-logic. The current slate of Western leaders, with the possible exclusion of the newest of them, Liz Truss, can be counted upon to make the worst possible decision at every opportunity until a sufficient amount of pain is inflicted upon their society. That regime change, hopefully peacefully, but perhaps not so peacefully, occurs. And we're beginning to see the signs of a rightward tilt, which we've been warning about, mm-hmm. which the European elite ought to fear in Sweden with the recent election, with Liz Truss's confrontation with reality. And with Italy as well, keep a close eye on Italy. You know, the far right, quote unquote, far right parties seem poised to make massive gains. We'll see what happens if and when Trudeau ever has the courage to call an election in Canada. The times there are changing.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been forecasting that the unintended consequences of a kind of degrowth agenda, and again, if this is kind of, maybe I'm wrong to label it this way, but sort of the great degrowth experiment of 2022, that it's going to have these unintended consequences. And you know, we're going to probably see a big return to populism and right-wing populism and some of the potential xenophobia and other issues that can come along with that. Dumi, I think we're going to have to cut it off there. Great having you back. It's been too long. I'm going to try and set an intention to have you on a little more frequently than this, but thank you again. And for folks looking to subscribe, do you want to just name the address that they go to on Substack?
Sure. Before I do that, I'd reiterate my gratefulness for having the invitation extended, and always enjoy talking to you and big admirer of your work and your team's work, both here and in your nonprofit activities as well. Interested listeners can go to doomberg.substack.com. We are a 100% subscriber-supported newsletter. We do not take ads and we do not take sponsorships, which we believe allows us to be as editorially free and as biting in our commentary as we like to be. And that's the model that we have designed from the beginning and intend to stick with. And it's been great. We have been shocked and humbled by the outpouring of support by our subscribers and the level of success that we have been able to achieve. We are truly doing the work we were meant to do, and for that we feel extraordinarily blessed, and we are forever grateful to all of our precious subscribers who are putting their hard-earned money to support our efforts. And so truly life-changing for us and the work of my life for sure. And always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris, and humbled to be included on a podcast that has so many great and brilliant guests.
All right. Thanks again. Look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure to subscribe, like, and review us on your podcast platform of choice. Until next time, guys.